That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? You alright? Look, don't adjust your headphones, don't look at the diary, don't look at the date on your phone. That's right, it's Tuesday, because this week is a two-episode two-shot podcast week. One today, it's Tuesday, hello, another one on Thursday. Last week we had, it was a busy week for us. Jodie's episode was kind of mad because it was in conjunction with the Doctor Who premiere, which was on Sunday of this week, and it was brilliant. She was fantastic. And then we were up in Manchester on Friday, a few days ago, for the Manchester Podcast Festival, with Ralph Little came to join us for a big chat. And also, I want to thank him, but I also want to thank everybody that came, and I spoke to a lot of people afterwards. It was such a good night. I mean, the joy of podcast is, especially this one, you know what it's like, it goes on as long as kind of what we need it to. Yeah, this went on, I think it was a good couple of hours. We were only booked for an hour, but I spoke to the organisers and they went, look, if it goes on, it goes on. And it did, it went on, and it was brilliant. We had a past Two Shot Pod guest, our kid, opening for us with some brilliant Manchester poems. And then I introduced Ralph, we came out, we had a big old chat. It was what it was supposed to be, and it was brilliant. So if you were there, thank you so much for coming. And also thanks so much for all the messages and all the new people that have joined us on the back of Jodie Whittaker's episode last week, which I'm so pleased that you enjoyed. It was a joy. I know she was dead busy. So for her to make time for us, and quite a lot of time, you know, I don't know if she does a lot of big long interviews like that. Not interviews, you know what I'm saying, a big long conversation. But it was brilliant to have her on. We did have such a laugh. And also I want to thank the BBC team and all the people at Doctor Who for messaging us and getting behind us and saying how much they enjoyed the episode. You know, things like that really mean a lot. And it means that other people get to hear it. So it spreads the podcast word. The two-shot podcast word far and wide, and more people can listen, which is kind of what it's all about, isn't it? Speaking of listening, this week you are going to be listening to a lovely natter between myself and the playwright Nick Payne. Now, if you've been watching the series Wanderlust recently on BBC One with Tony Collette, Steve McIntosh, It's got people talking, that's fair to say. I, for one, I think it's absolutely brilliant. Now, if you're not in the UK, I know it's going to be coming on Netflix very, very soon, if it's not on already. No, I don't think it's on already. I think it'll be on very soon. If you haven't been watching it, go back, get on the BBC iPlayer and give it a watch. I think the writing's brilliant, the acting's spot on. It ticks all the boxes, really. I really, really liked it. But, you know, there's been a few people complaining. You know, it's a little bit racy. It's, some people have said it's filth. It isn't that. But you know what? maybe that's the problem with putting something on like that. And the people over here, look, me and Nick really kind of get into that at the beginning. So look, if you've been to the theatre recently, there's a good chance you might have seen one of Nick's played. Where was the last one he had on? I think he might have been at the Donmar. So he's done plays at the Donmar with Danny Mays, was in one of his last plays, Constellations, which was at the Royal Court, and then it transferred to the West End, and I know it was on Broadway as well. So he's predominantly known for being a theatre playwright, a brilliant theatre playwright, I must say. But this was his first sort of footing into writing a whole series. And he didn't let anybody else write another episode. I think he wanted to maintain that sense of control. I think that's something else that we talk about as well. I don't think it was easy for him, but I think he's learnt loads, and it was an absolute pleasure to sit down and spend time with him. I don't know why I'm stuttering. What was I going to say? Oh yeah, that's it. So there's a little difference this week to the quality in the sound, and I'll tell you for why. I was working, doing the day job in London, and I invited Nick to come and meet me to record an episode, but producer Griff was up north, he was busy, so I had to record it on my very lovely handheld device. So it's not as sonically beautiful, because producer Griff isn't here to add his magic touch, but I guarantee 10 or 15 minutes in, you will get used to it, and it'll be totally fine. And you can listen to this. This is episode 58 of the Two Shot Podcast with Nick Payne. I'll see you at the end.
To binge and all that stuff. And somehow the expectation on a BBC show, in a way I probably wasn't aware, is still that you should pull in huge numbers of people watching live. And really, it's fucking hard. And very few people, you know, The Bodyguard, I mean, obviously is killing it, literally.
Yeah.
And with the figures. But, like, that's the exception, not the rule, I think, you know what I mean? And that's a writer who absolutely, as you know, like, knows how to structure a thing, knows how to make it, like, completely gripping.
Yeah, but also, you know, you were saying that you have done sort of very little telly,
uh-huh,
and also very little press towards the telly. And uh-huh, I was talking uh-huh to a mate of mine the other day, because the first time I'd heard you speak, even though I've seen some of your plays, was on Front Row.
Oh yeah.
And we were talking, I was going, God, fucking hell, you really held yourself with like humour and real dignity towards that, and I didn't really think I thought her questioning was slightly loaded
at times.
But I don't know what it is in this country that we have this stigma or attitude towards any type of sex or even talking about sex.
I mean,
I was looking at some of the press when it was out, and of course it's from horrible rags. Saying I pay the license for this.
I know.
Words like filth.
I know.
And
X-rated.
It's not X-rated at all.
My God, I know, it's so
I think what it gets right is it's got so much heart and it's really believable. Well, and also, good, because, all right, fair enough, we haven't really seen anything like this on telly before.
Yeah.
But it's happening.
Yeah.
It's not from a complete, of course, this is fiction, what we're watching, but it's not from a place of fiction.
Yeah. No, that's totally right.
So where did it come from? I know from a version, there was elements of the play, wasn't there?
There was a play in, like, I'm trying to think when it went on, 2010. But to be honest, I didn't really go back to the play. The play was like just a starting point, discussing with the producers. You know, I sort of had a meeting with them, and they said, we're looking, you know, we'd love to try and find a show, a contemporary thing about love, relationships and sex and all that. And I, because I'd written the play, which was a little bit about that, that was how the conversation started. But no, it's a totally different thing. So, like, Joy and Alan were in the play, and they had one son who's also in the TV show. But otherwise,
he's brilliant. I love him.
Yeah, I do.
I love both. I love both those.
Yeah, oh, good. I do. I mean, I feel like a profound affection for them both. Yeah, I think. Joe and Isis, they're just amazing.
And there was something about that scene from the other week, you know, when they kiss for the first time in the bedroom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And even as an audience member,
yeah.
And I hope this is a compliment and not anything. I kind of knew where it was going to go.
Yeah.
But the way that they played it was 100% believable.
Yeah.
And really, really warming.
Yeah.
Because I remember having a big smile on my face afterwards.
Yeah.
One that I'm pleased I was right, weren't you, where I was going. But also, execution.
That's really good. I think there's, you know, there isn't a lot of plot in the show. I think partly because first time writing for TV, I don't necessarily know or don't have enough experience with the mechanisms of how to use plot and all that stuff. And so, I think we tried to make the characters the driver of it rather than the plot. So no, it is like in episode one, I think you get a sense that she sort of fancies him really when he's talking to the other woman on the playground about Jonathan Franz and all that.
Yeah.
And it's great. I like the kind of thing where an audience knows where it's going and is therefore like anticipating through understanding what's coming rather than a sort of anticipation where you don't know what's going to happen, which is also great. But I think that requires like a totally different skill set that I don't think I probably have.
So do you feel like you put on a different type of writer's head to write this? Or
because I think I sort of had to. Yeah, because it was just so much, you know, six episodes and I wrote it all and I've never written that much before.
Did you want to write the whole... Did you feel like you had to maintain that sense of control? Are you a control freak, Nick?
I don't think so. I mean, as it went on, I must admit, my control freakery kind of revealed itself. But I think it comes from a place of not knowing... Not having been through the process before and wanting to, like, learn as much as I could. So, I did end up being quite involved. I wasn't really on set at all. I went on set for 2 days. I mean, that just seemed totally... like baffling to me. But also I just, unlike plays where obviously you rehearse for whatever it is, 4, 5, 6 weeks, and you're all collectively working towards the same goal. Actually, I was just so amazed that on set, there's a bit of that, but actually everyone may have prepared individually entirely differently. And it felt like it was more important that the ownership of the material on set is between the cast, Luke, DOP, and you know, everyone who's going to be doing it every day for 6 months. And while I loved going along and going, to me it was like a bit of a day out.
Yeah.
But everyone else is working, so I think I went on set for about 3 days.
But also, you've been working for the year before you start shooting, so...
And of course, actually, I was still writing, so I hadn't finished. So, you know, they started shooting the first 3 episodes, and I was still writing the final 3.
Yeah. But I think that happens. Gosh. That happens.
Yeah, I've heard since, so it made me feel good.
Loads.
Yeah,
that happened to a friend of mine who wrote and his first series that was on last year, and I know he won't mind me saying this, but Jed Mercurio still writes as he goes
Does
along.
He?
Yeah, because that's why amazing. We always used to get the first 3 episodes, and then you had to wait. Of course, he knows where things are going, but he wants to hand. Things wow. when they're more or less finished.
And does
you know,
he so. Tell you where it's going?
No.
No, really?
No. The only time I had so cool. an inkling of where something was going, and I hate doing this because it's not about me, this podcast.
No, come on.
But
I'm so interested.
No, it was only in series 3.
Uh-huh, okay.
Just before the handover of the last script. Because I'd been there for so long, I think he felt a duty to forgive the pun to tell me, which I was really grateful for, you know. But I didn't know anything, you know, for the first 2. You just don't.
Wow, amazing!
So you know, you're not on your own at all. I think a lot of writers do that.
It was sort of a blessing and a curse in that I was, because the scripts weren't finished. Because obviously, I was watching the rushes, you know, stuff coming in every day. And they really started to get a sense of what everyone was doing, like how they were sort of, how everyone was kind of fitting into the, I don't know, like the universe of the show. And so it meant, it's not that I wrote for people specifically, but it was just that I got really excited by how fucking good everyone was. And that just really helped me get through the last 3. And you know, and there were characters who weren't going to be in it, so like Royce, of course, who plays Jason, He was only going to be in two episodes.
He's great. He's really great in it.
Fucking amazing.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm going to put you in the whole thing. He's not in episode 5, but then no one is really. And he's only got maybe a couple more scenes in 6, but I really wanted to just write more for him. And so that bit of it was quite fun, but fuck, it was quite scary when it was like, trying to think, getting near Christmas. And
did you, what was your deadline?
Well, it had waited. it was fucking back in the summer. Like, it was August. Yeah. I think block one, the first 3 episodes shot from sort of around September, October, maybe up until Christmas.
Right.
And block 2 was starting January till about sort of March, springtime or something like that. And I finished the final episode about 2-3 weeks before Christmas, I think. So they had a really tiny time to prep it. And there were some scenes, like I wrote a whole sequence in a zoo.
Did you?
And they were like, I mean, God love them. They found a zoo, Chester Zoo, I think it was. And they were like, we've got it, but we can only get access to them. I'd scripted like baboons.
I was like, keep it easy for them.
It's like a total nightmare. And I think they were like, we could shoot the penguins. And I scripted it at night. That's the other thing. So there was no one else around in the zoo except Mark with a C and Joy. And they were like, okay, we think we can get it at night. We don't know how we're going to light the penguins. Because I don't think you're allowed, you know, for their environment or habitat or whatever, you can't rig up. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, suffice to say it never happened, but it's in the back pocket. But
writing television, once you handed in those scripts, did you feel a sense of a loss of control? I mean, were you getting... I mean, I'm thinking with regards to writing a play.
Uh-huh.
If you're handing a TV script and then you've got execs and producers giving you lots of notes, did you feel that you were compromised in any way, as opposed to if you were handing something in at the court?
Yeah. I think it took me the whole process, the whole of the development process, and then the edit as well, to figure out how to... take on everyone's notes, but understand or figure out the moments when you feel really strongly about something
and something that you've got to fight for.
And in a way, I've never really had to do that in theatre. Not that you don't, you know, as you'll know, not that you don't sort of have to make big changes or have to take big notes or listen to obviously everyone else you're working with. But in telly, there's again, as you'll know, there's loads more people. The pressure just feels greater. I don't know if it really is or whether it just feels that way. I haven't been able to figure that out. But no, I mean, I think I remember somebody saying to me, like, you should fight for the things you can't afford to lose. And I thought that was quite a useful thing.
Mm.
And so like, there was a scene, for instance, in episode 5 that I loved, and the performances were just really beautiful, and the scene was basically exactly what I kind of had in my head. I don't mean visually, but like the temperament of it.
Yeah.
And I found it so moving. But it just didn't work in the episode, and it really kind of killed me. I was fighting for it, going in the edit and going, go on, I think if we just go from his single to that, I think we can make it work.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, okay, you can do that, you can keep going on that. And then we were like, we screened it, everyone in the room, so director, editor, 2 execs, producer, music supervisor, post-production supervisor, all watched it live. And then at the end, turned to everyone, I was like, what do you think of that scene? And they were all just like, I'm so sorry, it doesn't work.
Oh,
and they were totally right.
Yeah.
But
because it's funny, isn't it? Because when you're in a rehearsal room for a play, to a point... you're there and you can edit as you go along
because you're seeing it come
to life and you're seeing it in the rehearsal room and you're going, actually, no, I thought this was working on the... Not that I've ever written a play, by the way.
Yeah.
But obviously I've been in a rehearsal room loads. So I suppose that's the difference, isn't it, when you're there
as a writer? It's so true. And I think you don't... There's something about you don't... Or at least I found this with the telly thing. I don't think you really know what you've got on your hands until you're in the edit. So shooting felt like this... completely new bit of the process that's totally different to anything I've done before, where you're sort of getting the footage and you're going, wow, fuck, is that how it's gonna look? You know, I don't mean in a bad way, but you just, I guess everyone working on it maybe has a slightly different picture in their head. And we've all talked about the look and the, you know, production design and the costumes and all that. And so I'm kept in the loop about all that stuff. But even still, when it starts to come together in the edit or the assemblies, you do go, oh, wow, that's what this is going to be like.
Yeah.
Whereas I think with a play, that happens much earlier. That's almost like, say, the first week when you do a read through or whatever, and you're with the company every day, and then you start to see, like, oh, I see, that's how they're going to do it. Right, great. And you get, I think you get a sense of what you've got on your hands in a different way, and maybe a bit quicker. Whereas I didn't really know what we had until we were in the edit, and really until we were, and then when it goes on telly, then you really go.
Did you feel a lot of pressure just before it was coming out?
I did get quite nervous, yeah. I
mean, was it sort of first night nerves in the theatre?
It was. But it's, what's weird is you don't have the same outlet, or at least I haven't figured out a way to do it, as in with a play. Obviously, you're in the room and you watch it, and then you go to the bar and you can chat to everyone, either as in everyone involved in the show, or if any audience are milling around, and you either listen to them going, that's fucking true.
I'm sure that doesn't happen for you.
Particularly a few times I've worked in New York, like, the audiences are incredibly vocal.
They're a different breed over there,
aren't they? Fuck yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. They love to chat during.
Yeah.
They love, like, rustling boiled sweets. But I find it interesting. You know, I really do want to know what people think, for better or worse.
So do you read reviews then?
I do, yeah. And Twitter, and like, it's, and I'm not even on Twitter, so it's shameful.
Oh,
I
know, so you got
so
on
dirty.
To, oh.
It's so dirty.
So that's, that Twitter's like your porn. That's awful, Rick.
Because like, so for episode one, I couldn't. I never really done it before, so I haven't done it with plays. I don't go on Twitter to, but, you know, I suppose the reviews with the plays come up either the night you have your press night or opening night, or the next day. So, yeah, those I do always read. God knows why.
Do you take them on board? Even, like, because I suppose if you take, you, I know I've said, like, we talk about this loads with other, with other, and not just actors, like musicians. And if you're accepting the good, then you've got to accept the bad, which is why I always try and.
Yeah, do you read them?
I don't, because I was doing a play years ago, and a really good friend of mine, who's a brilliant theatre director, he said to me something. I said, well, I haven't read the reviews. And he went, well, why would you? They're not for you. And he's, that's always so stuck with me, because I went, he's completely right.
Yeah.
And it kind of rid me of any anxiety of wanting to read them at all. Yeah. Of course, they're not for me. I feel a bit freer now.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I think that's completely right. I found that with the plays, because I didn't, you know, with the first play I ever had on, I was naively excited to read the reviews, because I thought it's going to be great. I'm going to get some really constructive feedback. I think they're really going to be thinking about me and about how I've done. And then you read them and you're like, oh, right, it's like 200 words. It's a summary of the plot. Well, I know that. Why the fuck are they summarising the plot? And then it was like a sort of thumbs up or thumbs down, and you might get an adjective, you know, which in my case sort of veers between like awkward or bookish, or, you know what I mean? And then it was like a sentence for the director, a sentence for the lighting designer. And so it's so true. You're absolutely right. Your friend is absolutely right. And exactly what you're saying. Like, you go, oh, I get it. They're not going to help me figure out really genuinely, deeply and constructively, like, where I'm going wrong and what then the skill set I'm sort of lacking. But for some fucking reason, with the TV, with Wanderlust, I thought, this is going to be so great. I'm going to get lots of really constructive. It was like being...
I've gone back again
to the
first one.
Like 10, 15 years ago. It felt, I don't know why, it felt weirdly similar. And then I read them and was just like, oh, right, fuck. They do not care about me, which is fine. And Twitter was, I mean, on Twitter, to be fair, I can just about see the funny side, but there were a lot of poo emojis after the first episode. That was like
so odd.
Sorts of
I find
stuff.
It really odd,
yeah.
But you know, television's such a—it's a weird
it
beast,
it's
you
like,
know.
Yeah, it's true. It's sort of it. I mean, I think I just got to remind myself that it's amazing to have a show on the BBC, and I think people, you know, for better or worse, feel a kind of massive ownership over it,
yeah.
Obviously in a literal sense, but also in a kind of cultural sense that goes beyond, we pay a license fee, we're entitled to X or Y. You know, I think people, a certain kind of person, like, really loves it. And I think when a show isn't for them, and it's, you know, and it is a weird intimate thing, like your TV is probably in your front room. You know, it's like the room in the house you might spend most of your time in.
I don't have a TV.
Do you not?
No.
Do you only watch stuff on
I watch stuff on commutes and, like, you know, I'm so working now in London.
Yeah.
If I, like yesterday I was on Split, so I didn't get back to like 9:40 and I had a drink and I couldn't really sleep because it was my first day.
Yeah, wow.
And I couldn't sleep the night before because it was my first
day.
So,
yeah.
So I just sort of watched a bit of something and then listened to a podcast. And
on like
sort of,
a laptop?
Yeah, just on an iPad, stuff that I'd sort of downloaded. Yeah. But
I think that, even that though, I think is interesting in that I think that's still, that is like, I don't know, I think it's sort of like reading a book. In that it's, I think you do feel an ownership over the thing, and particularly now, if you're watching on catch up or whatever, you control how and when you pause it, stop it, go back again, just like a book. And I think so. It is a really interesting way of watching the thing in a way that I don't know. It feels like 5-10 years ago, like you just didn't. You did watch telly, or you missed it, or you just didn't. You know,
only you tuned in week in, week out, and then people would have that conversation in the week leading up to the next one.
That's so true.
But I think there's arguments for and against the kind of way we consume television nowadays. Because I watched Killing Eve pretty much back to back, but only because I was given all the links for it. because I was really enjoying it. And it seemed like one of those shows that benefited kind of more or less rinsing back to back.
Yeah. That's
whereas something...
Well, like Bodyguard.
Like Bodyguard or Wanderlust or one of those shows... I want that conversation in the week.
Yeah.
And I think it's funny.
Yeah,
and
it's interesting.
Certainly from my point of view, and with anything, whether it's a book or podcast or an album or a film or telly or piece of theatre, I just go through all the arts there, just so you know what I'm talking about.
Juggling.
I love it when people either have a strong opinion that they absolutely love it or they absolutely loathe it. The worst thing for me is someone to go, fine is one of the worst things for me because it's neither here nor there, is it?
Yeah. I think that's quite, also, that's a tricky response when you're involved in something you've made and people are like, and they're a bit on the fence about it. I mean, I guess, I don't know, Wanderlust does seem to have divided people in a way I hadn't anticipated, because I didn't think there was anything at all, you know, like controversial or racy or whatever about it at all. I just thought it was like a warm, a little bit weird, I get that, and a bit awkward, so there's no doubt, but interesting.
I don't know, but interesting.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think it's weird. I do think it's really interesting.
There is a thing around sex, I think, definitely. And in a way, I wish I could tell myself it sort of makes me feel good about the show even existing, because it is stimulating a bit of conversation and people are going, like it was on Gogglebox.
Oh, was it?
It was.
What did they say?
they showed a bit from the second episode where Alan, Stephen McIntosh and Claire, Zoe Ashton, have sex in her flat, and it's like a bit clumsy, and he's sort of adrenalized and like just goes at it too quickly.
Yeah.
And then once he's finished, he removes the condom and he sort of holds up a condom and he says, "Where should I put this?" And she makes a joke, and obviously that's the bit they showed. And it was just so interesting, like people were you know, when they cut to the goggle boxes all watching, they all kind of gasp or cover their eyes or really. And I thought, wow, that's sort of...
But that's great.
It is kind of great, but I find it weird that something as banal as a condom... I get it, it's not a, like... it's not an aesthetically pleasing thing to look at.
No, but it's like a knife and fork. We've all used them.
Exactly. It's so true. And it's weird. And I bet if you showed them a clip of, like, you know, lots of people getting shot in some action film, they wouldn't cover their eyes. Like, you would, whereas... If I were walking down the street and you saw people getting shot at, I mean, thank God, you know, that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
You'd be hot, like, it would fucking shock you to your core. I think yeah. it certainly would me whenever yeah. I've seen an accident, you know, like a car accident or something. It is really shocking. Like, actually, violence is weirdly banal in a way. And it is, anyway, and I just, so I find it interesting that we can consume that quite easily, arguably pleasurably, in a way where the banality of someone going, we finished having loving consensual sex, we used protection, where should I pop this?
It's like we're ticking all the boxes.
Yeah, it's like, this is good for your health. And people are like, oh, fuck, it's gross. And you think, is it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, it's funny when you say about violence, I think, because we see it, we do see it all the time, so it ceases to become anything shocking. Yeah. But I remember a few years ago, and I was coming back from somewhere, and I was changing tubes at Camden, and I don't live in London anymore, so I don't, God knows what I was doing here. and it was about 11-ish, and I saw an argument between two guys, and they were both quite pissed, but one was more than the other.
Yeah.
And one of the guys just sparked the other guy out, and I could hear the punch on the face, and my heart just went, and it to see that...
Yeah.
Now, if I saw that on screen, you'd hear, like, the Harrison Ford, the punch,
and it
becomes almost cartoon-like.
Yeah, yeah,
it doesn't have that that effect that you see in real life.
And it's amazing how in, like, those sort of Jason Bourne films or whatever, I mean, I guess he's, like, a specially trained sort of killer, but they punch and punch and fight and fight and fight. And thankfully, I haven't been in that many fights, but when I was a kid, I was in a couple, and, like... fucking hell does it hurt. Like, it really hurts getting punched in the face.
Yeah.
And actually punching someone really hurts. Yeah. It really hurts your knuckles.
Yeah. Tell me, you've just spurred me on to take the conversation in the next direction. It's not about getting punched or being punched. Tell me about being a kid. Like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in a village called Wheat Hampstead, which is in it's sort of in Hertfordshire, really near Bedfordshire. So it's basically, I grew up on a road that joins sort of Hatfield to Luton.
Right.
So my dad was from Luton, and then him and my mum, she's from Wales, they met in Luton.
Whereabouts in Wales?
She's from a place called New Inn.
Whereabouts is that?
It's like a little village near sort of Newport, Cardiff.
Okay. Yeah.
It's like a little, it's the place I grew up in, it's like a little village. It's, I don't know really, you know, it's got a primary school, but it doesn't have a secondary school. So I went to secondary school like out of town, you know. Well, not out of town, but not in the village.
How was school?
I mean, I sort of enjoyed it, I think. I did, I mean, there was a point around like the mock GCSEs where I didn't do that well. And that really sort of terrified me, in that I just didn't necessarily want to stay living where I'd grown up. And I think I thought, is the only way to leave? I don't know, something like to go to university. I wasn't really sure what else to do.
Did you just want to get out of that area?
I think so, but not because I hated it or anything, just because I was really curious to just live somewhere else. And
Was there a reason why you did so badly in your exams?
I think I'm not really that academic, so I did okay GCSE wise at like, I did drama, I did all right at drama and English, but the maths, the sciences, fucking history, PE. That was no surprise.
I'm with you there, don't worry about it. So when you said you did drama, was there any point where you actually thought about becoming an actor?
No, never.
Why did you choose drama then?
I liked this. So I remember I had an amazing English teacher, actually, GCSE English teacher.
Yeah.
And we had All My Sons, Arthur Miller. No, Under the Bridge. Under the Bridge? What's it called?
Under the Bridge, Red Hot Chili Peppers song.
He was really renegade with Red Hot Chili Peppers. What's the one? Oh shit! This is
someone's listening to this screaming, screaming.
Call himself a playwright. Can't even remember the Arthur Miller play.
Was it? I'm going to look up now. I've just moved to get my phone for this.
It's the one where I've seen it.
I bet a lot of actor and a
Mark Strong, in fact, did it at the Young Vic. Yeah. Maybe this will help. And I saw Ken Stock do it also in the West End. It's the one where the guy. Italian-American family, and he takes in his cousin, I think, and the cousin sort of starts a relationship with his daughter or his niece.
Right. This is View from the Bridge.
View from the Bridge!
There
Under
we go.
The bridge shit. Anyway.
Okay, you can stop shouting now, everybody. Thank you.
Read that, and it really vividly stayed with me, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, there was just something about, it was the first thing I'd ever read, I think, like I wasn't much of a reader ever, that felt contemporary. Even though it was American and it obviously wasn't contemporary, it felt like, oh, I recognise the voices of these people, and it feels like there was no barrier between me reading it and sort of accessing it or understanding it in a way that, you know, when you study Shakespeare as a kid, I just found it impenetrable. I was like, these are dead people. It feels like a dead world and a dead language.
But also when, as kids, we're forced to read something by a teacher who's told that they have to give this, not necessarily teach it or inspire them, but we have to read this because it's on the syllable. That's not inspiring for anybody. So you're not, we're not going to open a book. I didn't read my first book till I was 21.
Really? Yeah.
Sorry.
There's someone who's going to tell us.
You know what I'm going to do?
Unplug it. Oh, well done.
Unplug that. I've just ripped the phone socket out of the wall in this hotel. It's all right. It's not a great hotel. I'm sure they won't mind. Because I was always forced to read things that didn't speak to me or didn't inspire me by people who didn't talk to me or didn't inspire me. So I think things like that do have to change.
Yeah. It's tricky. I mean, you really feel it, or at least I did, when you get a teacher who really loves the thing they're teaching, and it is amazing. It's sort of easy when you think back to plot a journey that feels logical, and you go like, oh, I loved an Arthur Miller, so obviously I never thought, oh, I'll write or I'll act or I'll get involved in drama.
Did you ever tinker with writing at school?
Not really, no. I mean, a little bit during A-levels, because you had to, I seem to remember. There was like as in A-level English, I think there was like you had to write a short story or something. But I never thought, no, I wasn't really doing it in my spare time. It's my memory, but maybe that's wrong. And it was only when I got to university that I did. That then I did start writing.
And this was York?
Yeah, this was York. But I didn't do anything in the first year because I sort of, as I was saying, I didn't do that great at GCSEs, so I worked my arse off for A-levels. And thankfully I got the grades I needed to get to York. And when I got there and discovered that the stuff you had to attend was voluntary, I was like, what the fuck? I killed myself to get here. You're kidding me. I don't have to go to this. And I was paying for it. And I thought, wow, okay, I get it. It's like, if I want to learn about, I don't know, Ulysses, I can go along. If I don't, I can just do whatever I want. And they were like, yeah,
pretty much.
As long as you hand in some essays. So I sort of, that was when I got into reading, really, you know, through the library. They had at York, which is obviously huge, and they had the play side was amazing. Like, they had, my memory of it is like, it was huge walls of plays, contemporary, British, American, European, and then like all the old stuff that, as I say, I'd struggled with as a kid, or the Shakespeare, you know, I could read a bit of that, but then also novels and non-fiction too. But no, the first year at York, I did nothing really except get drunk quite a lot. And it was only then in the second year I got into the drama society because...
And what were they doing? Were they sort of putting on plays and writing stuff, or...?
It was a mix, yeah. They have a little space. I assume it's maybe still the same. A place called the Drama Barn, which was, as it sounds, like a little barn they just converted. I think it seated about 40 or 50 people, you know.
Oh, right, so dinky.
Really tiny, and like bare minimum of stuff. I think there were four lights and like one chair. And you could apply to put on a play, and yeah, you could do a pre-existing play or you could write your own. So I wrote a play and staged it in the second year and then did the same thing again in the third year. And I think I quite enjoyed the social bit of it.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that you could change it, you know, that you could sit, watch it with an audience, which is like a horrifying or a horrific experience. But also, if something wasn't funny, you knew immediately yeah. there was no fucking around. It was like, okay, woof, I get it. And there were only tiny runs. It was like a Friday, Saturday and a Sunday.
Mm.
And I loved that you could rewrite it then, that it was like a living, breathing thing. It wasn't sort of fixed, you know.
Did you feel that you were learning on the job there because you were getting immediate responses?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, stuff that I thought was hilarious. You know, if it died, you learn loads instantly. And likewise, stuff, the bits of my writing that I thought were like profound. You know, you write some beautiful monologue and you think, this is going to change lives. I think people are going to really, this is going to really get to a lot of
this
people.
Sounded amazing at 1 o'clock in the morning.
When I was off my face, I thought, I'm going to change the world. And then, of course, you see someone looking at their watch or someone, you know, it's just thankfully it was kind of this is sort really pre smartphone. So, you know, now if you see a play, I mean, one of, you know, that you've written, people will literally just get out of their phones and start typing. Think, fuck, is it that bad?
Oh, God.
But this was pre-smartphone. Yeah, so I did. That's definitely the thing I got hooked on, is the bit of the job where you can make and remake throughout the process. And, like, in the edit on the TV show, for instance, I could have done that for a year.
I loved that.
Whereas with a play with an audience, it's quite scary. You know, trying a new thing live is quite scary. But in the edit, you're sort of protected in a way. You can move stuff around, totally restructure.
Yeah,
it's really quick to do, and the stakes, I suppose, are quite low. You know, other than the cost of hiring all the equipment and your editor and all that stuff.
I suppose if you don't, if you never really tried, as scary as it would be,
mm-hmm.
then you're never going to learn. And like, mm-hmm, even mm-hmm, if you do fail, what's really the worst?
Yeah.
That if you really say you look at it, you write it down, you go, what's the worst that's going to happen?
Yeah.
My ego might be a bit bruised.
Yeah.
I might be a bit sad for a few days, and then I'll pick myself up and I'll start again. But maybe I've learned something from that.
It's so true.
Do you want to just go back to a bit of how you were feeling at home?
Mm-hmm.
Not that you wanted... You wanted to kind of escape, but you were still quite happy. How did you feel within yourself going to York? Did you feel a sense of freedom, or...
That's interesting. I think it took me a while to figure out... I think because I wasn't academic, and in my head, going to university was... So no one in my family had been to university, not my parents, any of my cousins, grandparents certainly hadn't, you know. I was really intimidated. And I think for some reason, that, honest to God, that thing of the fucking stuff was voluntary, just made, it was such a relief.
Yeah.
Because I thought, okay, I can limit the things, the bits of this where I'm going to be really out of my depth. And to be honest, it was the first time I'd ever met people from private schools. And I just had always assumed people from private school are like... this other level of kind of fucking hell, they're going to be like robots. They're going to destroy me.
But it's difficult that sometimes, isn't it? Because even from my point of view, if you meet people that are academically and intellectually superior to you.
Yeah.
There's some people, the great ones, who don't make you go out of their way to make you feel that you're stupid.
Yeah.
And then there's the other ones that it's water off a duck's back and it makes you feel...
Yeah.
inferior and you just sort of revert into a shell. I know that.
Yeah.
And it's a really horrible feeling, but that says more about them, obviously, than it does about
us. No, it's so true. There's a certain kind of, like, from memory anyway, like, academic who thrives on almost, like, alienating you through a kind of wealth of knowledge that they've accumulated. And obviously, like, when you really think about it, it's like, well, that's their job. They're in their 50s, say. I'm 18. I've just got here. Obviously, they should know more than me. You know, it would be stupid.
I don't even know who I am as a person.
Why would I know the fuck about this book or this writer's life? Like, you've done that your whole, you know. No, one of the best, the most freeing things was, like, somehow really embracing the phrase, I don't know. And not in a sort of, not in ignorance, but going, like...
But in honesty.
Yeah, like, I don't know that. I've never heard of that. And there was definitely a bit of university where I pretended all the time I'd read stuff. And not in a, like, I hadn't done the homework and hadn't read it, but in a people there who just had read everything. Fuck, they knew the whole, like, canon of this kind of literature or that kind of era. I just didn't know any of that stuff. And I would just lie because I just thought, God, I'm going to get sort of found out.
Sorry, pause.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Thank you. Genuinely, I've just been delivered a bottle of gin. Yes. I got given a bottle of gin at work yesterday. And I got rung up this morning saying, well, the driver left it. I said, I'll pop it round to the hotel. I'm with Nick playing with another shot of gin on a Wednesday morning.
Yeah, let's do it.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because you were saying about how freeing it was for them to go, hey, this is voluntary. So in a way, it was inspiring because you weren't having everything thrust upon you. You were choosing what inspired you.
Yeah. It's true. It's really true. And I think then I seem to remember in the like second and third years when you started to be able to choose your modules, even then there was another level of freedom and you could, I guess some of the things you had to study were fixed. But yeah, that was when I sort of got into film a bit too. And
what, into the study of film?
The watching of film. I mean, similar to all the books and stuff, I hadn't really seen that many films. And then this whole world of, you know, I guess you sort of try. I heard someone saying this, and that they were saying, like, most people access, say, film or TV through the mainstream. Really, that's where you start. You don't, like, you're not 15 going, I love the French New Wave or something. Like,
I don't know. I know a few people that have said that. they're also the people that go, of course I've read everything.
Yeah.
they're not the ones that go, sorry, I've no idea what you mean.
Yeah, no, come on. We all get into like Transformers or like Batman, you know what I mean? You're not starting off.
Oh, Raiders of the Lost, I think Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Back to the Future, yeah, Jurassic Park. Or, you know, I don't know, maybe as you say, someone who goes, oh, I love a bit of Italian neorealism on my nights out.
Get out!
So that was fun, like watching films that were... So it was, obviously, the only two references I can drop were literally the things I studied. So the French New Wave and Italian neorealism. And I'd never seen anything like that in my life. And bits of it, I was like, this feels up its own arse.
Yeah.
Like, baffling. And then just you would, when it really worked, I was like, fuck, this is just gripping in a way that no other film I've seen has done.
But it's really interesting. It's like a novel, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
if you start reading, whenever I buy a book, I always try and read the first page in the bookshop. So then I can get, someone told me to do it. And I went, cool. Because I really love reading now when I've got time.
It's very
hard with a 7-year-old child and, when you're talking for a living. But I do love it because it's the one time, it's like going to the cinema by myself. It's the one time that I can have for you, and I think that's really important. I've completely lost my thread. I don't know what I'm
talking
about.
No, it's so true. I really,
oh no, sorry, that's what I was talking about.
Oh, go on.
When you were talking about the films and some of it feels like it's up its own arse. If you get, sometimes I get a block on a book and I can't really get past this page and I'm kind of rereading. Yeah. So then I try and reread. And if I still can't, then it goes. But it's like a film, one of those films.
Yeah.
And you sometimes watch it and you go, is it for me? I don't get it.
Yeah.
And then you go back and rewatch it.
Yeah.
And then you can make your judgment, can't you? Yeah.
It's a bit like, I think I had that experience with Dennis Potter. Like when And I think probably it's because I was just slightly too young, really, the first time I saw some of his stuff, like Lipstick on Your Collar. I sort of remember trying to watch that.
Yeah.
On Channel 4, I think it must have
it
been.
It was on Channel 4, because I remember buying the script for it, because I really loved it.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Because if people haven't seen Lipstick on Your Collar, I don't know if it might be on 4OD. They've got, I mean,
I'm sure
Channel 4 have got
it
that.
Should be. Yeah.
Stuff's on there from years and years ago. Yeah. But I remember what I loved about it, which I don't know if it's the same as you, that it just went into this dreamlike musical sequence. Yeah. And it was very rock and roll, was it, if I remember rightly?
Yeah.
And that she was that blonde bombshell and Ewan McGregor was... Oh, it was fun. And it was all the backdrop of the war as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. But I think with his stuff, the first time I watched some of it, I was just... I didn't really know what to make of it. Couldn't quite figure it out. But then, when you... Somehow watching lots of his stuff seemed to make watching bits of it like a richer experience. You start to see all the, Yeah, like the way they lip sync, don't they?
Yeah.
Lip sync when you're yeah. And it's the same thing in Singing Detective. I mean, I can't remember which comes first or whatever, but and that was just so interesting. I mean, and that his yeah. Anyway,
but also
so
no, he was such a unique voice. Nobody was hell, yeah. That was just going back to television yeah. again. That was like event television. Oh, yeah. The new Dennis Potter was coming out.
Yeah,
I remember Singing Detective just sort of blew up, didn't it?
And you think, I mean, you think about now. Sorry, not to go on about it or go back, but the stuff around, say, Wanderlust being controversial, X-rated, and you go, like, it's like people forget there was Dennis Potter that was, you know, I think, like, genuinely challenging. And I suspect, although I don't really know that much about him as a person, was part of his intent, was to shock a bit, was to kind of divide, or was to... And so it's weird that a show, in which people can have loving, consensual sex is seen as, like, tricky for the BBC or a kind of controversial prospect, and you go, like, they've been supporting writers like that for ages, or even Jimmy McGovern. You know, I'm thinking of The Lakes. I hope I'm remembering that right.
Yeah,
I remember that was pretty dark. I mean, well, anyway,
a lot of Jimmy's stuff's very, very dark.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Again, I mean, and not to go back to Wanderlust again, but. It's kind of saying, all Jimmy McGovern stuff says, it's got a message, it's saying something about the society that we're living in today.
Yeah.
And going back to what I said earlier, you know, of course it's a piece of fiction, what you've written, but things like, someone's going to connect with it. This is happening somewhere to somebody.
Yeah. I know, it is funny. I think there's maybe something about, anyway, I don't know, maybe it's a tangent, but the thing of... I think I like to think the thing that people are struggling with watching this show is that because the show's about an inability to communicate, I think, in a way, that actually that's really hard to watch. It's like, painful. And there'll be, obviously there's people that are just like, it's shit, I don't want to watch it. I get that. But I think people who are really upset by it or like viscerally angered by it, I do think that means the show must be doing something, or at least I hope.
Because they've got some sort of emotion out of it.
Yeah. Otherwise, I think, as you say, when, like, I certainly do this, if a show is fine and it's not really doing anything, then I will just stop. Like, you don't, obviously, you don't sit through 5-6 hours of something.
Well, you can't invest that time.
No.
I mean,
no.
I'm a bit like that with theatre and with film.
Yeah.
This is probably an awful thing to admit. I am perfectly fine with not coming back after the interval.
Yeah.
Because it's I don't really want to invest anymore in something, and it's a waste of my time. And actually, it's getting me a bit down.
No, there's a weird thing with an interval where I don't really like them. I don't like writing them, and most of my plays are pretty short. They're under an hour. And I do think it's weird. The interval I just find weird. I don't, you know, you don't do it at the cinema. I guess TV has adverts.
Oh, they used to do it at the cinema.
That's true. That's so true.
When I started going, I remember I saw Battlestar Galactica, the movie, which I didn't enjoy, really.
Right.
I wasn't really into it in Warrington.
And there was an interval where they used to be interval,
I think, when they changed the reel.
Wow. Yeah, that's true. I suppose it's just a weird thing to give someone, to give an audience a moment where they aren't watching something. They're not like engaged with the work. You go out to the bar, and as you say, it's just, I think, I don't know, particularly once you've got kids maybe or whatever, you just think like, fucking hell, it's already 10 o'clock. Why am I? And it's not over? You're kidding me.
I mean, I do always ask when I ever go to the theatre, the first thing I always go is, I know. How long is it? And I went a few months ago for the first time in ages.
Uh-huh.
And a friend of mine went, a friend of ours bought some tickets. I'm filming in London. I'm in, definitely. I like that. And I'd love to see you. Brilliant. Yeah. So what's it called? Oh, right. I haven't heard of that. How long is it? 3.5 hours. There's two intervals. I went, there's two intervals. Come on. It's Thursday night.
Yeah, it's true. I think that you've got to either... It's got to be time at one side to drink or eat pre or post going to a play. And generally, if a play, say, starts at 7.30 or 7, if it's, like, fucking long and they start half an hour earlier, you're probably rushing to get there.
Yeah.
Particularly if you've got kids, say, and either you've got, like, a grandparent who's come round, blah, blah, blah. And then if it's 3+ hours, you come out, that's the end of your night. And I think a play should be the start of your night, like, not finish you off.
Yeah.
A 2 intervals is, I wouldn't do it.
But even one, I suppose, you know, there's, of course, there's arguments for and against, mm-hmm. but if you're telling a story, you're telling a story, there's a start and finish in one space. So it is kind of filmic in that way.
Yeah.
You just want the story to go and not dip. Because then you go back in and you've got to ramp it back up again. Yeah. It always takes people 4 or 5 minutes to sort of settle and get back into the mindset, and something very important might have just been happening on stage.
Yeah. No, it's weird. Yeah, I think I'd cull intervals if I could.
That's Freudian.
I'd cull interviews, yeah.
And do you feel now that you've sort of really more than dipped your toe in the telly stuff, would you like to have a balance of writing theatre and television?
Yeah, it would be great if you could do a bit of everything.
Why can't you?
I think you probably can.
I think you
can. I mean, there obviously are people who do that really well. I suppose I found the telly thing, it's so long, you know, it takes so long. And I found, like, at the moment, it's, you know, it's going out week on week. I find it quite hard to... Obviously, I am out doing other work, but... I find it hard in that my brain is still slightly on Wanderlust, even though, really, I should be moving on and doing other things, you know.
Because it's in the ether.
It's like, I don't know, I can't quite let it go. Like, I really want to know what people think, and I really hadn't anticipated... That I think I thought the first one would go out, you'd understand how it's going to go, you'd get who's watching it or how they're watching it or how many people are watching it, and you'd go, job done, and now I move on. And it hasn't been like that at all. I'm really, as I say, like, checking Twitter and all Googling yourself, and so it is weird. I can't really shake it off, in good and bad ways. Like, I'm really curious. Every week I really want to know what people think, but a bit of me is looking forward to when it's finished, like, really switching the switch or shutting the door or something and doing other stuff. So anyway, that's a long way of saying, yeah, I would love to do a bit of all if you can manage to do that. But the TV I've definitely found much, much more all-consuming than the theatre, which has such a finite, you know, a press night.
Yeah.
And it just is like the end. I know it's not for the actors.
No.
But for me, it like largely is. And you'll go back and you'll watch it and you obviously pop in and say hello to everyone, but you're not making big changes, or you're not...
No, because you've had that 4 or 5 weeks to do that.
Yeah. It's true. The structure of it is just so different. And I think because I was so used to that structure, where, as you say, it's like 4 or 5 weeks all working together. It feels like you're all building it. Then you get in the theatre, you do tech, and you go, oh, right, fuck, it's not quite what we thought we had in our hands. Then an audience comes in, and you really figure out what it is. And then you mad race to press night. And then you kind of go home, and it's really compact.
Yeah.
The writing might take however long, but the actual bit of doing it is, what, like a month, 2 months? It's really tiny.
But it's intense.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's good that there is a finite ending on a press night, where you go, right, I'm done, I go home, and you do or don't read the press. In my case, do. And then just, like, weep for a day. But the TV thing is just, you know, it was, like, over a year to write it all, 6 months maybe of shooting, and then probably 3, 4, 5 months in the edit. Then there's a sort of pre-publicity bit, anyway, which was just all so new to me. And I think that's the thing, maybe because it's the first time I've done any of it.
Yeah.
It feels really sort of visceral in a way that, I don't know, maybe when you do it lots, it feels less of a shock. But no. Fuck, it probably doesn't.
No, because it doesn't really... I was talking to somebody the other day, actually, you know, from an actor's point of view, the job doesn't end, even though you may have finished filming 3 or 4 months ago. It doesn't end until you finish doing all your interviews and that part of it, because it's still with you and it's still there.
Is it weird when you have to do an interview months and months after you shot the thing and you might not even have seen it yet? You know,
I very rarely watch anyway. So
really? No, do you not watch?
Pretty, I try not to. When I have to.
Yeah, it's interesting.
If I have to, I have to.
Right, right.
But it's very rare that I really have to.
So if it's going out, we can't, you won't be watching. No. Yeah, it's really interesting. It's funny, whereas I feel, I mean, obviously it's so different. I'm obviously not having to watch myself, but I feel compelled to watch it. I feel like I have to support it. You know what I mean? I feel like if I didn't watch it, I wouldn't be doing my job.
But can you switch off? Because the reason I can't is I can't really watch. Because you're, in a way, you're not watching yourself, but you're watching your words come to life and add all this colour.
Yeah.
Are you going, oh, I should have changed that.
Yeah, well, there's always like little bits or like a cut point or something where you think, were we right? Was that the right thing to do? I suppose the nice thing is, although I don't know if this is accurate, because I don't really write autobiographically. There's like a few things in Wanderlust and some other stuff I've done, but really it's totally made up. So I don't have the kind of, you know, writers who write stuff that's either is autobiographical or really personal. I guess watching it must be so different, but I thankfully I have a bit of distance in that sense. But yeah, oh my God, like last night I was watching it and you think like, oh, I think I overwrote that scene. I'd have cut that word. That was a bit too much. But then thankfully, because all the actors are so great, you are going, fuck, that's a good performance. Like, shit, look at that. That's so great. Yeah. And like, so that bit I really love. But
then again, you know, you have to ask ourselves that question, where does it ever end? Mm-hmm. Are we ever going to get to that finish line where we go, yeah, well,
I know,
I'm very happy.
I know.
And then if we get there, well, then what do we do?
Yeah.
Because we've completed something. Yeah. I personally never want things to be complete.
Yeah. I know it's so true.
Because I can only learn by sort of making my mistakes and failing.
Yeah. It's true.
We were talking about structure before, and I want to just ask you in a different way.
Yeah.
About the structure of how you write. Do you have a specific... Mm-hmm. Right, I'm going to get up, I'm going to go to the office, or is it more, I don't know.
Yeah. No, it was, or I do. It's slightly changed, because me and my wife had a baby a year ago, so it's like, I had to change a bit. But largely...
You've got no choice.
I've got no choice. Yeah. The baby forced made me do it. I think, I write in the mornings, so I sort of get up around 7-ish, and I maybe, again, it's just kind of pre-baby, so it's slightly different, but I would write till about 8 till 1 pretty much every day, and other than stopping to make a coffee, I would just be at my desk and write. And I always worked at home, just a room in the house, and then in the afternoon I'll either read, which is quite nice, or go for a walk. I really like going for a walk
just to rest the mind.
Totally. I just walk around parks in like figures of eight for like, if I can. I can't now, again, post-baby, but pre-baby I could walk for like 2 hours a day.
I did that this morning. Really? Hyde Park.
Fuck, that was nice. I really love that. And you are inevitably, you just end up thinking about the thing you're doing. But it somehow feels like a different kind of thinking to the thinking you're doing at the desk when the laptop is in front of you.
Do you just write? I mean... Mm. Or do you sort of self-edit as you go along and you're writing and you think, this may be shit, but I still have to just get it out.
Yeah. No, I kind of pour it out and don't... I mean, I quite enjoy doing research and sort of taking notes, but research not in an, you know, going back to that academic thing, not in an academic way, but I've really got to enjoy talking to people. So any character who does a particular job...
Mm.
I'll always go and meet a bunch of people who do that job and just buy them a coffee and try and just ask them loads of like really basic embarrassing questions and just go, I don't know about your job. Seems to me like it's fucking interesting. What you do, can you tell me? And I've done that on everything since, I don't know, last 5, 6, 7 years.
God, because even if you spent half an hour or an hour with that person, if you got one thing from them, it could be amazing. And that could spiral into something else, couldn't it?
No, completely. And I quite enjoy then. You know, some people don't want to hear from you again. That's fine. But some people, they're happy to read a script and they'll give you their notes. And, you know, and you're not necessarily, although some people do, you're not getting, like, script notes about structure or character. You're just getting their, like, technical, well, actually, I would never say that if that were me in that situation. And I find all that stuff so useful. So that bit, I can take ages. Mm. I might spend, like, months and months or a year.
That's really interesting, that's though,
really
isn't it?
Really fun. I mean, I met so many, you know, so for a play I wrote called Constellations, which had a physicist in it, or a cosmologist. I mean, I didn't, as I was saying, I was bad at science. And maybe that's why, because actually doing this means I get to plug all the gaps that I never... all the things I never really understood when I was a kid or something. But yeah, I met loads of physicists, loads of cosmologists. And there was a character in that play as well who was a beekeeper. So I met a bunch of fucking beekeepers. And there was a guy who had... I hope he still exists. This is awful, I should know. But at the time, his company was called I think it was called the London Honey Company.
Right.
And I just emailed him and said, I don't know about beekeepers. Sounds interesting. Do you eat the honey? Like, what's the deal? And he was like, well, I'll show you. Come and so I, and he was incredibly cool. And he drove around on like a Vespa, I think, or a very cool kind of little bike. I don't really know much about bikes. And he had hives all over London.
Right.
So he had hives on the roof of the Tate, I think. This is going back. So I don't know if this is still accurate. Hives on the roof of Fortnum and Mason. And then in some fields in like somewhere south. And he drove me around for a day.
Wow.
And you know, just it's like a mix of, well, this is just kind of fun. And you're just picking, the more you get people to talk, the more you reach a kind of point where they're talking anecdotally. And not that I'm stealing their anecdotes, but it just means people initially might talk about their job quite formally, but really, like, I want to know how they spend their day, what they're doing, the hours they work, bits they love, bits they hate, blah, blah, blah. And that stuff kind of creeps out the longer you talk to them. Presumably not unlike doing a podcast, you know.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I was just thinking that, there's kind of parallels there.
Because
I never want to do is have, like, a question and answer because it's not helpful for anybody.
No.
And everybody gets quite tense. If we're having a conversation, then we're learning something. We're learning so much about each other in the conversation. And then someone, like you were spending the time with that beekeeper, you weren't necessarily stealing anecdotes, but you might have been inspired by something that you said, completely. And that could have the domino effect.
Yeah,
to going back to that laptop and writing a great scene.
Yeah, no, I really love that bit of the job, and I didn't even know you could do that, you know, but I think it just came from a really basic trying to write about someone or a profession or a person that I'd never met or didn't know anything about. And then I just thought, fuck it, I'm just going to email them and see if... And I just have been lucky and kept finding people really want to talk about their jobs, you know, and they don't, I think, they don't want to be misrepresented. And, you know, you're transparent. You're like, this isn't going to be sort of accurate. Probably you might think, well, it doesn't quite work like that, but I'm not going to betray what you tell me or your experience by sort of contorting it entirely. You know, I'm much more interested in if something, I'm trying to think of an example, but if someone's told me something that is, you know, means that a story I had in mind can't work because I don't know, some element of their job or the way their industry works, wouldn't really happen.
Yeah.
I'll always follow the sort of, you know, real bit. And I just think it forces you to think in a different way. And yeah, I've always really enjoyed that. And it's weird, I suppose I've mostly met scientists, but then on Wanderlust, you know, I met loads of psychotherapists. And that, I've never had therapy. I didn't really know anything about that world. And it was so interesting. Yeah,
I bet.
Yeah,
the music I wanted to
talk about, please,
because
great.
I was talking to somebody the other day, and I was going, "Oh, and is it episode 2 where it ends in the club?"
Yeah,
and then Laura Carner comes in,
yeah.
And that was great. And I love Laura Connor. Anyway. Yeah. And the music for me didn't get in the way of any of the storytelling. It sort of added to everything. Great. And I was wondering, is that something that was written in the scripts? Or is it?
Well, so some of it is.
Right.
I wish I could claim credit for all of it. But I can't.
Yeah, I think I listen to a lot of music when I'm writing.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And so I think...
Do you listen to music when you're reading as well?
No, I don't. I can't, actually.
I can't.
Reading, no, I feel like needs a totally different environment.
I need to concentrate.
Yeah. Ideally, yeah. I'd be in the middle of nowhere to read a book with no one around, no phone or anything. Whereas writing, I love noise, I love music. I often, you know, you end up writing in cafes and it's great when they're really busy. I feel less self-conscious.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Whereas if you're in, I think it's probably because I might end up in a cafe all day. And I've, because of that scene in Fleabag, I think it's ruined us for it. Do you remember that? There's a bit where the cafe that Fleabag runs, and this guy comes in, gets out his laptop, his phone, another device, plugs them all in, and she goes, "Can I get you anything?" He goes, "No, I'm good." And it just, I think I can never go into a cafe. Because you go in, you go, "Hi, what's a cheap, like, filter coffee? Do you have any plugs?" And is there Wi-Fi? And I just feel really bad. But when it's busy, obviously, I don't feel that bad. And then I'll use their plugs. And so, anyway, what was I saying? All that? Yeah, so I quite... Writing is... I like noise. Mm. I like lots going on. And, and I always listen to... Music, that's right.
Yeah. Sorry.
And so, I think I just started writing some of the stuff I was listening to in the scripts. And I would write some sequences and go... Either if it was someone in a scene, you know, presses play on a thing, I'd write in that track and then script a sequence. So I'm trying to think of an example. But not all of them. So there's a Bill Withers track in episode 2, Use Me, that they sing in the car.
Yeah.
And that was scripted as that track. And then there's a Jamie Woon track, in 2. There's a kind of montage split screen when they're getting ready to go out. That one was scripted. And the gig, actually, at the end of 2, I wrote in the band. So I wrote This Is The Kit performing Magic Spell because I was listening to that track. And there's a great... I don't think it's a live version, but there's a sort of alternative version on an EP of theirs, which I think is called Rusty and Got Dusty.
Right, good title.
Good title. And it's a really great version of the track Magic Spell on that EP plug. And
have you heard Bill Withers live at Carnegie Hall?
No. Right. Oh, wow.
Yeah. If you can get it on, do you listen to vinyl?
I haven't got that much.
Right. No. If you can find it, okay. Get it.
Is it rare?
I don't know if it's rare or not. I seem to have had it for donkeys, but it's like a real go-to.
Right.
It's not only is it a brilliant album, but it's live and it's at Carnegie Hall and there's something about his voice.
Yeah,
and the crowd really do feel like that. It's a really good listen. It's like a Pop Picks recommendations. Craig and Nick's record.
And I think, I really wanted to do a gig in the show that felt like a gig. Whether or not we achieved that, obviously, is up to people to decide. But we got This Is The Kit. I don't, producer, music supervisor, just wrote to them, I guess, and said, I don't know whether they ever read the scripts, whether they said, like, he wrote you in, will you come and do it, or whether they just asked them. But they were so great. And, we shot it in Manchester. In the soup kitchen? I hope I'm getting it. Yeah.
You are getting it right. It's a great venue.
Fuck, it was great. So I was on set that day.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, it was amazing. They did 2 tracks. They're both in the show, both live. But then lots of the other music, so the Lorcana, or what else is in... I'm trying to think of another example. Were either, directors, either Luke, who directed the first 3, or Lucy, who directed the second 3, working with Ian, the music supervisor. But we all kind of wanted... I said early on, through no other reason than instinct, like, I'd love to use lots of music in the show. I'd really love it to be a part, like, integral to it.
And someone comes to you and goes, yes, there's clearances
yes,
there.
Exactly,
this is going to cost a lot of money.
But the great thing about having never done it before is
even if I do know how hard it is, I can pretend I don't. So they go, that's going to cost a lot of money.
What, really?
Oh, really? Oh, well, I'll try and cut some material from this or that. Let's find a way to make all this.
I'll make sure I edit that bit out so then on your next holiday, you can keep going.
Fuck. But I think, actually, as long as you're, you know, it was in script stage, so long before pre-production or shooting or anything, I think as long as you're transparent, and you demonstrate that you're prepared to work within the limitations, or within the, not limitations, but the, like, I don't know, what's the barriers? It sounds even worse. But whatever, the parameters,
yeah.
That's what I mean. Then I think people see that you're sincere. Like, if I'd gone, I'm a fucking artist, I want lots of music, they might have gone, no, it's going to cost a bomb. But I think I had a feeling from people I'd spoken to sort of warm up for figuring out how TV works, that original music in TV, I think, can be quite rushed, maybe, or can happen at the last minute.
Mm.
And I just thought, why wouldn't it be great if we knew the tracks we wanted? Some of them we can script, some of them we'll find in the edit, but and then we can really cut to them and not have to kind of wait for a score and get a score and go, oh, it's not quite right or whatever, you know, and I got the feeling that, unlike a film where you might have a very long time to score a film and a very long time in the edit, that, you know, the TV edit's quite compressed or whatever. Anyway, no, so we all, it's great. I'm really glad that on Twitter people seem to enjoy the music.
But music adds, it can add so much, mm-hmm. and then take away so mm-hmm. much in the mm-hmm. first few bars mm-hmm. of a song.
Yeah.
It's the very delicate balance, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, and figuring out a kind of track that suits your main character versus the kind of track that suits, like, the music around the kind of teenage characters is, I think, quite different to the stuff around the,
well, it is, because you've got a, I think why it struck me so much mm. is there's a great palette of the music, and it really adds to it, just going back to the Laura Kahn one in that club, because of the way that track, I don't know the musical term for it. It's like you're turning the volume up, and it's creeping slowly. Yeah. And then they see each other in that club, and the music is building as they're looking at each other. Yeah. So adding to the drama.
Yeah. No, it's great. That's a great track.
Yeah.
And then episode three after that starts with another one of his tracks for the sort of basting a chicken montage. I'm sure he's delighted about.
I'll ask him. We've been trying to make him at work.
Amazing.
Coming on the podcast for
amazing.
About 6 months, oh, and right. We keep missing each other.
Right.
I'll probably have to edit that bit out because I don't want people knowing. But I might leave it in. Who knows? Nick Payne, thank you so much. That was brilliant.
Thanks. Oh, thanks very much.
Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And another episode is done. Nick, I've never met Nick before until he came to meet me outside the hotel, and he's such easy company. Very, very, as you can tell, as you just heard, really easy to talk to. Not worried about talking about certain topics, and, you know, really honest, and that's what we want. So I really hope you enjoyed that. And, you know, are we just a bit prudish over here? I don't know. I think probably we are. But anyway, look, if you haven't seen Wanderlust, do go and check it out, because I think it's a bit special. I think it's really, really good. And as we said in the podcast, it's kind of interesting. Things shouldn't be for everybody, and that's good. But there's nothing worse than, you know, what I said, like, fine, I don't, it should be one thing or the other. Get people's backs up or get people clapping and cheering. That's amazing. And wouldn't the world be boring if we all had the same taste? I think so. Well, look, thank you so much for joining us and downloading and subscribing. And look, I guess I'll see you Thursday. Usual time, it'll be up. It's with the fantastic JB Barrington. I'll see you Thursday. Take it easy. Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.